When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Buzz Podcast, and this time we are looking at True Detective Season 4, Episode 4, and I am of course joined by Dave Hendrick to discuss it. Well man, how are you?
I'm good, I'm feeling much better, thankfully enough. So I had some kind people reach out to me during the week and tell me that I sounded, and I quote, dreadful on the few podcasts that I tried to do, so you know, so it was good to hear.
Yeah, it's amazing how clearly it comes through in the voice, and especially if you're having to stop to wheeze, or like I was last week with the nasal thing, and it's not really conducive to this kind of work, unfortunately. But we do try to battle on, and I see Dave's already back up and running with his daily reds and stuff like that, and has done about 49 podcasts today already. I have actually been sort of completely knocked out by something in terms of just pure fatigue and aches and pains. I'm hoping it doesn't take in the same way as it manifests with Dave there in the chesty cough and all the rest of the horror show. But so far, I'm just going to keep stubborn and say that I'm keeping it at bay with as much legal medication as I can possibly get my hands on. We are here to talk about this latest episode in the True Detective Season 4 saga. Now, a little bit of anecdotal stuff from me to start. I'm talking to people at work who are watching it. They're mad into it. But I got two separate texts from people after episode 4. And they were along the lines of, what the fuck is going on, Trev? And I thought, oh, that I did not see that coming, because I thought episode 4 was possibly, with the exception of the fact that there are a few real jump scares and really leaning into the supernatural bits, I thought it was the most sort of pedestrian of the episodes in terms of, well, there's nothing really that wildly surprising here. Like, obviously, that supernatural stuff is quite shocking. But people seem to just, that was when the confusion hit. I would have thought it was the maybe first or second or third episode, but no, that's where it hit. Now, that's been the sort of feedback I've been getting, but people are still engaged. The only negative things I've heard, and I haven't gone looking for it, Dave, to be honest, this week like I did last week, but the only negative things I've heard are sort of entirely predictable, where people are probably armed with some sort of prejudice beforehand, and it's eking its way in to whatever they say about it. I did hear one person just say, this is just flat out bad, and he didn't have any particular agenda apart from just thinking that he wasn't entertained. So I absolutely appreciate opinions like that as much as I appreciate, you know, people fanboying or fangirling. So far, what are you making of it? Like, has this one cemented your enjoyment of it? Has it taken from it? What sort of feedback are you getting? I don't know if you're watching it, say, with your missus or if anyone you know is watching it, or what's going on there.
Yeah, myself and the missus are watching it, and we're both very much invested, both very much enjoying it. She made the point that it was sort of the episode that the least unfolded. It was almost like a bridge episode. You used the word pedestrian. It was kind of like a mad twisty road that finally hit a little bit of a straight and just carried on the straight, didn't look for any additional detours. I think we both thought that was in many ways a positive. I've seen again a few people that have said they don't like it. That's fine. It's not going to be for everything, for everybody. Not everything is. Nothing is for everybody. There's no one size fits all. Like, you can look at the greatest shows of all time. There's people that don't like season one of True Detective.
It's the yardstick people are using to beat this one with. And listen, that's a very, very high bar. And also, I think an awful lot of people, what's coming out is, they're not out overtly saying it, but they're irked by the supernatural side of things. They don't like that. They want it to be more sort of nuts and bolts detective stuff. And I've heard it said, like in season one, like what were they watching in season one? In season one, there's horrible occultic stuff going on. Yes, it's more rooted in sort of horrible, perverse, gritty, pedophilic, you know, sort of dark, dark stuff. But it is tied up and around and into occultic themes for sure. So I don't know, maybe it's just the overt horror nature of this one. We've got a lot of body horror, we've got a lot of overt, well, that couldn't happen, could it? Or is this actually happening? Or what do they mean they're seeing dead people? And there's all these kind of like, so I think it's quite overt. So maybe if you don't buy into that, maybe that's going to be a problem for you. I guess that's probably what it is for most people, actually.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And look, you mentioned it as well. Look, there's the jump scare factor. Some people just don't like that. You know, some people don't like horror at all. And that's cool. Absolutely fine. Personally, I love horror. So for me, that's well in my wheelhouse. I think as well, like, there is going to be the hardline element who are, you know, Nick Pizzolatto or Pizzolatto fanboys. And because he's obviously made it clear he's not really keen, they've decided they're not keen either. Now, his reasoning is different. He's got, there's definitely some bitterness there with him. But look, it is what it is. I think the majority of people that approached this season with the right mind frame, which was to just take it as its own body of work, I think are enjoying it. They might not be loving it. There's obviously a wide-ranging scale of how much you might like something. And that's absolutely cool. But the only thing I dislike when I see people giving opinions on stuff is when they try and force comparisons to other things. Like, you know, there's no reason to force a comparison with this season and the first season, other than the fact that they're both under the True Detective banner. As I said to you last week, I think if this had just come out under the banner Night Country and didn't have the True Detective moniker, I actually think people would be a lot fairer and there'd be a lot less negativity. And it's not like there's been huge negativity, but I think there would be an awful lot less even than what there's been. I'm glad to hear though you didn't listen to any overproduced under talented podcasts in the week that's passed. That's growth on your behalf.
I felt a bit guilty about exposing our listeners to that kind of nonsense, and then also felt a little bit guilty that some of our listeners might be nodding along in agreement with some of that nonsense. And I don't want to be divisive. I do want this to be a little warm hug of a podcast.
Leave the divisiveness to me. That's my wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, but not in this show, buddy. No. Not in this show. Yeah, we are actually trying to find our better selves on this one. So I have a different way of starting this. It's interesting. We're both talking about how this is the episode where least twists and turns happen. I've never taken as many notes on my second watch through as I did on this one. So we'll use those entirely to just skip from episode to episode or scene to scene, and we can land wherever you want. But if you don't mind, I have a few questions here that I was left with at the end of this, at the end of the four episodes so far. So I'm just going to read them out. We may or may not come back to them, and you may or may not, I don't know if you have a pen or something beside you, you may or may not want to just focus in and try and help me answer one of them. But I am left with far more questions than answers, as I think should be the aim of a show like this. So the first question, probably the predominant one, because it ties straight into the supernatural thing, is, so why do the people of Ennis see things? And is it, I wonder, going to turn out to be, and I'd be a little bit disappointed by this if it was, is it going to be as something as prosaic as the shit water, some sort of pollution issue in the mine? Is the mine actually going to be what Rose thinks it is, some sort of a portal place? Why do all these things, when they are appearing to Evangeline, point at her like a scary meme that we've seen doing the rounds on the internet? Why is Liz not more rattled by the fucking one-eyed bear? Why is she not rattled by that? Why is she going straight into, yeah, there's no such thing as God, all your hoax pokes budget? You just had a one-eyed bear that is the resembles your child's toy, stop you, cause you to crash and basically look in your window. Or did that not happen? That's the other part of the question. Is the spiral thing going to turn out to be some sort of a cult again in a reach back to season one? Is it a DNA reference? That just occurred to me this week. And what are all the eye references about? So you had the bear, I mentioned that. You had the woman with the eye patch at the protest meeting. You had Heiss, who's got one eye sort of wonky and he's got that burned out cornea. You've got loads of drawings in Leah's room with eyes in them. And then you've got Holden covering one eye, playing that peekaboo game with his mom. So there's obviously some sort of highly obvious symbolism there that's going to play out, I hope. And then the last thing is the lighthouse. What is that lighthouse symbolism about? Is the light actually what we think? Is it good? Is it hope? And when you're walking away from the light, like Julia does in this episode, is that you walk into death? I don't know. Loads of questions there, Dave. Feel free to ignore all of them and we'll get started into the episode. Is there anything there that grabs you in terms of something you wouldn't mind responding to, or one that you can relate to, a question that's also been preoccupying you?
No, there's a couple there that did pop to me as I watched this. The scene with the one-eyed bear is the most obvious one, because like you said, it's her child had the one-eyed bear, and the bear comes right up to her window. And again, I was left wondering, did she see that in, like, was she knocked out and imagined that happening? Because, or did it actually happen? Like, we didn't get any clarity, because when Evangeline comes over to her house, she never mentions that she had the crash. And we don't hear any more about the crash. We don't hear how she got her vehicle out of the snowbank and back to her house either. She crashes the car, the bear appears, and the next thing we know, she's back at her gaff. So, do you know what happens there? The why do people see things one is one that's been playing on my mind. And myself and my other half were talking about this, and we were saying, like, you know, it's only a 6-episode season. So yeah. She was making the point that not a lot gets revealed in this episode. You would have thought that now, as we enter into the back half of it, we'd start to get more and more reveals. We didn't get any big reveals in this episode. So she was saying, like, is it going to be a thing where we either get no information about certain things, where they're just left unanswered?
Yeah.
Which would frustrate the bejesus out of me.
Same.
Or is it going to be that we get, like you said, is it going to be something very straightforward and a little bit disappointing, like, well, the mine have poisoned the water and the land, and that's why they see things, because they're all a bit mushed in the head because they've been ingesting whatever the mines have been putting into the ground. So there is the possibility that that becomes a bit of a damp squib of a plot line, or it could be something that doesn't get explained and is just sort of left unanswered. Both of them would be disappointing outcomes for me. I hope she lands the plane on that.
Yeah, same.
It's quite a big theme through the whole show. A subtle one, but a big one.
Yeah, she has to stick the landing with that. Has to. And here's the other thing as well. I read a quote from Miss Lopez during the week where she said, and this might be a revelation to some people who haven't come across this. She said that the killers, I think was the quote, have been in front of your eyes for the whole show. So it's not like we're going to find Clark and that's going to be the bad guy. That's what this is the quote. Now, maybe I'm misinterpreting it. Maybe it's a red herring. Maybe she's deliberately fucking with us. But that led me to wonder, okay, well, who might it be? And obviously the obvious one is, like, oh, Hank's in charge of some redneck cult of spiral worshipping crazies, right? That's where I would have gone immediately. But I saw this incredibly interesting, and you might think nonsensical, but worth a watch, documentary on YouTube about someone who is positing the idea that Navarro is actually the killer, and that she dissociates, and that she's, you know, having similar experiences to what her sister and her mother did. But that was a bit of a wild out there theory. But what about that concept, Dave, that the killers are actually in front of us the whole time?
The Navarro one did cross my mind. I haven't seen that on YouTube, but it did cross my mind. Because there are little spells where she does disassociate. And yeah, she goes into an almost trance-like block. And I did wonder, like, given the history of mental health, given there's definitely some underlying bitterness with her, given the unresolved cases of the past, it has crossed my mind that is it something she's doing? And we saw in this episode, like, the violence in the fight scene, yeah, where she almost completely loses all sense and reason. And I was thinking, like, she's one step from completely having an out-of-body experience here. Now, obviously, we'll get into it. She doesn't win that fight because she's so badly outnumbered. But in the 1v1 part of that fight, that's a grown man, and she puts him on his backside multiple times. And, like, yeah, we know Carrie Reese is a professional boxer, so she can carry that off. She has credibility in that. But is there more to Navarro that we don't know in terms of her own background that might lead to her having that ability to take down a grown man or multiple grown men in the one go?
Yeah, and in one of the big scenes in this particular episode, she does say that she suspects that she's going to suffer the same fate as her mother and sister, and she says it comes for us, and she says she's cursed. So maybe that's a further hint that, you know, there is this, maybe it's a slowly descending condition. But let's get into this, because, like I said, there's a huge amount of notes here in terms of just getting through the incidents. We probably will pick and choose where we decide to land and have a chat, but we begin with Navarro still listening to the white noise and can't sleep. The white noise is there, obviously, to, you get the impression Lizzie, get the impression, is a troubled soul herself, and a very, very highly active mind, and we see her not able to sleep. It's 3:25 a.m. and what she does is turn off the white noise and decide to watch that horrifying Annie K video again several times, which is clearly disturbing the hell out of her. Her reaction is to go into Leanne, sort of fix her hair, and we see this affection, this maternal affection. And as she's leaving the room, we can hear Annie's screams in the background. That's just, again, some of that clever sound editing that they do with this. But here we have a little question, which it struck me at the time last week. And I was wondering, where is this environment that Annie's in? And there's quite a lot in this episode about the fact, highlighting the fact that these are some kind of ice caves, that these bones we can see in the background, we find out later on from one of Liz's many ex-lovers that they are ancient, and that there are ice caves in the region where Annie's body disappeared. So this is quite an interesting twist, and I'm just going to take it up as far as the next little episode. You can take what you want out of it then, because as we see Liz out and about driving, she comes across Julia, who's stripping her clothes off like the guys from the Salal Institute did, in a way that's reminiscent of that Dyatlov past thing that I told you about in episode 1, and it was explained to us by Pryor in episode 1 or 2 as well. And she's obviously incredibly distressed and initially sort of fights back, but we again see for the second scene in a row this incredible caring, like I say, maternal, kindly side to Liz, who's as hard bitten as they come. Like, I mean, there's something about the way Jodie Foster says, "Ah, fuck off," or, you know, stuff like that. She has, there's a bang of the Irish about her in the way she I like the way she swears. It's very good, and her hard oars are quite a thing. So yeah, I thought that was a very interesting way that we begin, and it's sort of that opening sequence ends with Navarro thanking Liz, and we're making these steps back towards each other that have been threatened to be made so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It is obviously baby steps for the two of them. They're both quite prideful women, and there's obviously there's something we don't know. There's still more that we don't know about that incident, that double homicide, or murder-suicide as it was. We know more than we did last week, where we found out more than we had the week before. So I assume we'll get even more in episode 5. But there's clearly something more to it than what we're being told, because both of them are kind of beaten around what actually happened and why they fell out. But this was interesting. Like, again, you mentioned with Liz and the way, you know, her reaction was to go in and fix Leah's hair and that maternal side. But I think we see that maternal side as well when she is dealing with Julia. Like, it's very much that kind of almost like an aunt, kind of an older, like, I'll look after you, I'll take care of you, calming, soothing, because Julia's in complete disassociative state and has clearly lost her grip on reality as she starts to strip her clothes, like you said, like the lads from the mine. But the theory behind why they took their clothes off has been hypothermia. She's not suffering from hypothermia here, so it's something else. And like we've said before, there's the mention of she multiple times through different episodes, and it. We don't know what she or what it are. We don't know if they're the same thing. Navarro mentions later on, like you said, how it comes for us. Did it get those lads? Is that what happened? Is that why they stripped their clothes off? Were they, will we find out that basically, like, just to use an example, like some sort of like worm in the brain type thing, where Julia and Evangeline's mother had it first, but it was slow working with them, whereas with the others it was more impactful, kind of immediate. They went from perfectly normal to all of a sudden they're running around and taking their clothes off out in the ice. I'm really curious to find out more about that side of things. Like, is there the same thing that's afflicting Navarro's sister? Is that what afflicted the lads from the research center, but in a more fast reacting way?
Yeah, and listen to you there. I'm actually going to be gutted if they don't go full. Yeah, there's some weird shit happening here. I don't necessarily need a monster, but I will be very, very disappointed if there's not some, oh, you know, nature goddess thing at least, because there's something. It's too much stuff to resolve with some sort of pat scientific materialist response. I can't see a way that you can just go, oh, like the, you know, the Dallas thing, it was all a dream. You know, I really don't think that's possible. But they have shot it in such a way that, you know, Liz experiences what Liz experiences, like we said there a second ago, on her own. And Evangeline experiences all her visions on her own. Like when she's with, is it Lund, that scary scene in the last episode, she's on her own. When she sees, when we have the flashback scene. And again, that's a really good point you make. Like, is Liz a reliable narrator? Or is she not a reliable narrator? We don't know. We do know that she has, in different situations, told fibs. But there's a real set to between them in this episode later on about, you know, you saw something and Navarro denying it. But we see that she sees something. We see that she sees some horrific version of the lady who's been killed screeching and pointing at her. And later on, she sees her sister float past, and then she sees her sister screaming into her face as well. So these things happen when she's on her own, and they have a very obvious impact on her. So it's set up in a way that there's plausible deniability, I guess is what I'm saying. So I hope they don't go for the cop out. Let's move it along. We see Liz is told that, you know, that guy, Captain whatever, is coming over, taking control of the bodies, that kind of stuff is about to happen. And a really nice little detail, at one stage he's in Liz's office and he takes some water in a water container and he sniffs it before he puts it into the plant. I think that might be a low key little subtle nod that he knows that there's some sort of fuckery going on. Certainly he's very aware of the dodgy water, but why you would think there would be dodgy water in a container that someone's brought into work, I don't know, but it's very, I thought that was an interesting little throwaway.
Do you know how say, oh, they're a bit rare over there, it must be something in the water? It's quite an Irish thing. People from that boy, there's something in the water over there. We, you know, now people say that. Like, maybe it's kind of a little kind of inside, you know, he's from the bigger city. The boy's out in the boonies, there's something in the water out there. Maybe it, because obviously she's been sent there. She's not from this area. She's not from Ennis. She's been sent to Ennis kind of as an outpost. And I wonder, is it like a little kind of, you know, this is what we think of ye back where I work sort of thing, do you know?
Absolutely. And if you're watching this and you're not thinking of Flint, Michigan, and you're not thinking of Obama drinking the water performatively and saying, it's good, you know, there's probably something wrong with you. Like Michael Moore made a whole movie about it. Go and check it out if you haven't seen it. He may not be your cup of tea, but he's spot on the money with that particular observation. And there's still no improvement in that place, which is quite remarkable. We then learn about Otto Heiss, because Pryor's gift is to go on the computer and find all the things. And Liz has asked him to see if there's anybody who's suffered with similar symptoms to the Salal boys. I nearly called them the Halal boys. And he digs up this Otto Heiss guy who had ruptured eardrums and both corneas were burnt. And again, you know, this guy has a history of violence and he'll come back into it later on. Then there's the little scene where yet again we come across another person who Liz has slept with, much to Navarro's amusement, as they call around to that teacher, that geography teacher's house, and looking for help and finding ice caves and maps and all that type of thing. And they pretty much decide that there are ice caves near the body, which means where the body was found, which means Annie was killed in one place and then moved to another to send a message. This is the suggestion. And I think all of this is to make us think, yes, there is a killer, right? That's basically, I think, what that's all about. And then we find out in that scene as well with the teacher that the bones in the wall are likely prehistoric whale bones, and that those caves are a death trap. And that cave system we discover, drum roll please, was mapped out by a guy called Otto Heiss. So that little section, there was a lot of stuff that happened quite quickly there and had to tie a few things together. But that's what happens when you have a big sprawling story like this, I guess, Dave.
It is. Like, that's the thing. It is a very wide-ranging story. It's quite an ambitious story that she's put together here. And obviously, given there's only six episodes, she is having to sort of open things up a little bit quicker maybe than, say, would have happened in season one where they had, like, 10 episodes. But Otto all of a sudden becomes prevalent for two reasons, despite the fact that we didn't know who he was or didn't, you know, beforehand. So now you want to know more about Otto. Now we need to find Otto. We need to see where he's at, what he's doing, and can he help here? And I think it's really well done. I did find the scene where they go to the teacher's house, the initial part of it just hilarious, the way Danvers insists that Navarro be closer to the door and kind of stands half turned away, and the door opens and the wife is absolutely disgusted to find Danvers on her doorstep. And Navarro turns around again to ask her, is there anyone in the town that you haven't fucked? And then your man appears and the way he goes, he says no. Seems like he's answering Navarro's question because of how it's said, but he's saying, no, you can't be here because it's Christmas Eve, which is, it just plays really well.
It's very well done. Even he's so awkward when his wife comes in, he bangs his head off the light and stuff like that. It's done very, very well. And if Liz is the proverbial fuck machine, and fair play to her, then poor old Hank is quite the opposite, as we see him go to the airport to pick up his foreign bride who's been leeching away all his money. Stands there, he's got a little rabbit in his hands as a little token gift, and for a minute he thinks the air hostess is actually going to be her, but no. And the plane goes off and we see him go back to the office and break out the booze, and and then later on we see him in the house and he's covered the bed with rose petals and he's picking them up one by one in what is probably the most tragic scene I've ever come across. It's just awful. He's got like a solitary bottle of pink champagne in the fridge. If the idea is that we're supposed to laugh at Hank, then I think for me the sympathy thing won out there a bit, even though he is a little. He's a terrible set of lads, obviously. Yeah. You know, he's abusive to his son, all the rest of it. But then he seems to be this one of these kind of, you know, torn type characters that there's probably some amiable things about him. And I don't know if the idea was to sneer at him over the course of those scenes, but it kind of had the opposite effect. And we saw
a little warm
interaction between him and the son, and him chewing.
Did you notice as well where the son says to him, "You didn't send her any money, did you?"
Yeah, and he doesn't answer.
He sidesteps the question, but the son knows why he sidestepped, and there's a little sort of drop of the head, like, "Dad, what have you done here?" But like you said, I think it is to, you know, it's incredibly pathetic, the scene of this man standing with a little furry bunny waiting for this woman. And he clearly doesn't really know what she looks like either, because the air hostess, he genuinely thinks it's the air hostess, and obviously it's not. And then goes back, like you said, the way he picks the petals up one by one, because what most men would do there is they just grab a hold of the duvet and they give it a flick and they send them all into a pile. And in that pile, they would stay. But him picking them up one by one, like, it does kind of drive that sympathy side. Because as we said before with Hank, like, he's clearly a terrible set of lads. There's not a whole lot of redeeming features that we've seen about him in the few episodes thus far. But there's a loneliness to him. And you wonder, is some of the reason he is the way he is with the son because the son left him and went and had his own family? And like, as we've found out, like, he's sort of been on the take as well. And you'd wonder, did his life spiral really badly? Because when he was, like, we saw it with the ice skates in the last episode. Clearly he was an attentive father. And the fact that he kept those ice skates, which most people would have chucked out because the son is, what, late 20s now, clearly, you know, those skates are 20 plus years old, but he's clearly got this sentimental feature to himself. There's a loneliness. At some point, he must have been fairly decent at his job to have been promoted to the rank that he's in. So
doesn't he say that the wife left them? Wasn't that a point that was made at one point?
I think so. I think you're right, actually. So
that could have been what broke him or whatever.
What broke him. And then, like, all he had left was Peter. And then Peter left him as well. And maybe some of the abuse towards Peter is intended for the wife. And he's almost transplanting Peter into the place. Like, this is how I'd like to speak to the wife I saw her again. I'd be harsh and critical and not necessarily abusive, but maybe he would be.
Well, Leah does call him an animal. Leah refers to him as an animal. So obviously that physicality has happened before. Would be the suggestion. And the way they were trying, the way he was going up until the end of the last episode was, I was genuine. Oh, Hank is going to be the leader of some sort of cult of crazies here or something. He's definitely going to be, you know, there's going to be the equivalent of the good old boy network that we saw in season one, and Hank's going to be right in on it. And we know he's corrupt.
He might well be. We might still get to that he is the leader of this sort of cult of hillbillies, but he might also be almost a victim to them. Like, he might be a patsy, someone that they realized was weak and that they were able to sort of manipulate to their own, because clearly he's been manipulated by this Russian who's played on the loneliness. And there might be more in that as well. Is that somehow connected to the hillbillies? Did they put him in touch with this? Because how else would Hank get in touch with this Russian woman? He doesn't seem like a very internet savvy type of guy. No. And as I said to you before, like, he's clearly not very technologically sound or you know, modern in his thinking, because when she asked him for pictures, he was sending pictures of pictures. So he's a little bit simple in that regard as well. So there's a lot more to find out with Hank. And I think so. I think he's a really interesting character.
That scene with the skates, there's a line that he says, I don't think we mentioned it last week, where he says to Peter, blood is blood. And again, that just made me think, okay, there's definitely going to be something here, because there is sort of the, there's very much the community is riven. It seems to be mostly the natives, native people who are, against the mine, and then you've got the people who have been, who've come there because of the mine, who are nominally the outsiders or whatever, the white people or whatever. And again, there's ways that they could go with that, and I hope they don't drive it down too much of a dodgy route there, but it's interesting for sure. It's set up well. And if we get a little Hank cameo, we also get a little Rose cameo. Now, I'm sure Fiona Shaw loved this particular episode, so all she had to do is get herself up in a nice dress, swan around smoking a few fags and having a few drinks, and I think she had all of about 5 or 6 lines. It's a weird little scene, and she just basically, we just see that Rose has fucking gone to town and really Christmased the bejesus out of her house. There's food everywhere. Who it's for, I have no idea. Again, there's a fondness between her and Navarro that I really want to get to the bottom of. I have a theory, but I'm not prepared to release it just yet. And she, one of her key lines in the little scene with Navarro, who just calls round for a bit of Christmas cheer, she, of course, gets in this line about, you know, she had to do all the decorating herself because the elves were drowned in global warming. And that could be read as, yeah, global warming is a load of bollocks, or yes, global warming is very real. And I'm not sure where they're driving this, honestly, to be honest. And we also find out that she's a very serious professor in a very serious school who was writing very serious papers. And she walked away from all of that. She called it meaningless. She called it noise, all that academia. She said she was looking at the stuff that she was writing and she just thought, what's the fucking point of this? And this, she was attracted to this place where it's much quieter. Again, quote, except for all the fucking dead. So I didn't know what to make of this scene. It seemed a bit... It wasn't jarring. It was just an extra layer of character building, but I'm not sure what I learned.
No, see, I was the same. Like, she doesn't tell you what university, doesn't tell you what she taught, doesn't tell you what she was writing papers on. But I assume at some point we'll find out. The line, it's really quiet except for the dead, I thought was really good. And again, plays into more of, you know, what the different sort of, like, remember that scene with Peter and the delivery guy in the truck?
Yes.
And the delivery guy, you know, says different things to him about sort of the dead and kind of playing up that kind of supernatural afterlife sort of thing.
He's basically almost sneering at Peter and saying, come on, lad, cop on to yourself. It's Ennis. This shit happens. You know that.
That's exactly it. She's playing into that as well, but she's doing it with Navarro, who already knows that, so they don't need to go any further into the weeds on it. But I did think it was a really interesting... that when Navarro calls round to Rose, Rose doesn't know Navarro's coming.
No.
And yet Rose is all dressed up for company. So who's her company to be?
And you know, seriously, what is all the food and decoration about? It's remarkable.
That's it. She's cooked for 40.
We can only assume Travis has a terrible appetite on him.
That's the thing. Travis is a hungry boy. You'd be hungry too if you were dead. So it's just, you know, it's really interesting. Like, was she going to put the food out as some sort of offering? I thought that scene was really interesting. Didn't give us too much, but gave us quite a bit at the same time.
I'm just hoping we cut back to it next week and we see Rust, who's gotten over his nihilistic attitude and he's just a big fat lad now and he was delighted to come over from his mammy's cooking. That's basically what I'm hoping we get in episode 5. So to push along the story, we see this little interaction with Derv Le Kirwan's McKittrick, who has called Liz because the mine offices have been vandalized with the word murderers, and we work out that it's actually Leah who's done it. And we see Liz having to ask McKittrick, whose husband she slept with, not to press charges. Leah doesn't take this intervention well or in the way that she should. In fact, all she does is get annoyed with Liz for taking their side. She's very much acting out in sort of what you would expect more of an early teenage way than she seems to be a little bit older than that. But she's very much sort of, like I say, pinning her colours to the cause. And Liz, by dint of being both an outsider and white and her mammy, her, you know, adaptive mammy, is getting the brunt of it. And Christmas is totally ruined. You know, we see Liz chucking the turkey in the bin and she hits the vodka hard. And of course, because it's Liz, she decides to do some work. And work for Liz means watching that horrible Annie video again and again and again until she actually works something out. She works out that there's a power cut in it, and there's a power cut in the Clark video that the Spanish lad made when he was doing his little video for his socials. And she decides she's going to ruin Pryor's night and get him to give some Navarro some back up as they head out to the nomad camps to Gak, Skaff, and see if they can find out anything more from Tagak about this situation. It's also in the background, little honorable mention for Mazzy's Stars in the Dust playing in the background, which will enhance anything. The soundtrack is really good and it seems to be a little bit on the nose at times if you listen to the lyrics.
Yeah.
My hearing's not great, Dave, so I often have the, you know, subtitles then. So, you know, the way sometimes song lyrics would flow over your head, but I'm seeing them and they're often very on the nose, like in terms of the subject matter of what's happening on the screen and the lines that are playing in the background. It is quite effective. It's been well done, that aspect of things, I think.
It is. Like when we do our wrap up episode after we do, you know, the six, when we do episode 7 for us, I think the music is something we should definitely have a good look at, because I do think it's been brilliantly done, including just the opening theme song, which I think is tremendous. But a couple of notable things that came out of this. When Derv Le Kirwan first made her appearance for the first time in this episode, I mentioned her to my missus and I mentioned Bally Kissangel, and I was horrified to learn that my missus had never seen Bally Kissangel. Which is, you know, it's Irish TV royalty. Even if one of the primary characters is Stephen Tompkinson, who's obviously an English gentleman, a very good actor, but it is a tremendous Irish show. The first couple of seasons are among the best things that have ever been made in this country. The other thing was when Danvers is having the argument with Leah, and Leah's getting ready to leave, and Danvers says something along the lines of, "Just stay and have something to eat. I'm going to cook the turkey." And Leah leaves, and then the camera comes to this turkey looking very lonely on a table. Like, that turkey's going to take about 7 hours to cook.
Yeah, yeah.
You weren't just throwing it in for 20 minutes, like. Which I just thought was funny, because it's clearly very late on Christmas Eve by this point. Well, you assume it is. It's hard to tell because it's daytime, but everybody was finishing work and stuff. So you're guessing, and all the other stuff has happened after they left work. So you're guessing it's probably about 8 or 9 o'clock. Considering Peter gets the phone call, goes off with thing, and then comes home and gets straight into bed. You're guessing that when this scene with Leah and Danvers happens, it's probably about 8 or 9 o'clock. And she's only going to start cooking the turkey at that point. Which, you know, it just seems silly, because you'd be up till 4 o'clock in the morning trying to cook it that way.
Well, it made for a good scene and good symbolism.
It did, very, very good. And yeah. And as well as that, where are you going? Where are you going? I'll go to such and such. But she, obviously, Leah had already called Peter's missus to come and pick her up because she walks his door and the missus is sitting there waiting for her.
Yeah.
So, like, it is very, very good. It's really well done. I thought the scene at the mine where Danvers and Dervla Kerwin have their little back and forth was quite interesting because there's that little power struggle. But again, we see from Danvers this maternal side that she has towards Leah, where she's saying, like, she's basically pleading, like, don't fuck up my kid's life here. You know, okay. if she gets a criminal record, it's going to fuck her life up. Now, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of career potential in the Ennis area for anybody other than maybe going into the mines or joining the police. Now, joining the police would be wiped out for with a criminal record, and going to work in the mines would be wiped out for if there was a criminal record that was relating to the mines against her. But I just thought it was interesting the way Dervla Kerwin's character sort of there's a moment where she realizes
she has
I
power.
Now have yeah. the upper hand on you.
Yeah.
The roles are reversed, and there's a smugness, and the way she just turns and walks away.
Yeah,
Dervla Kerwin's a very underrated actress. It should be pointed out.
Yeah, it's well, she's looking for a lady who must be getting into, a slightly more advanced age, fair play to her. And just
52.
That Mazzy, 52, there you go. That Mazzy Star song is playing over Leah, actually, as we see her kind of bonding with the aforementioned Pete Pryor's Mrs. I can't remember her name. And the lady formerly known as Laundromat Grandma. and they're making some sort of, bread or pastry or something. And it seems to be a very overtly, she is now with her people type thing. And it makes it all the sadder, I think, that Liz is on her own. And now Liz is charging across drunk driving to get to Eccleston's character, who's whitening his teeth and watching Elf. And it's all quite comic, this scene. And she finds his gizmo in the middle of sort of a semi-seduction scene. And it breaks down into a chat where he actually tells her that she was a better cop than him. But he says, you were terrible with people. And after Jake and Holden, that's her son and her ex, it got worse. Nobody wanted to work with you. Nobody wants to work with you now. And the only thing that I got out of this actually is he tries to stop her from driving home. Navarro tried to stop her earlier on from coming to, do the Tagak run. I should have mentioned there at Tagak's place, they find a spiral on the ground. They find some of Tagak's possessions kind of neatly left. And then this little piece of rock or stone with the spiral on it. And when they come out, the rest of the nomads are none too happy at seeing the police again in this place that's supposed to be immune to the police. And when Navarro, I don't know which of them it is, I think it's Navarro, holds up the little piece of rock with the spiral on it, the threatening dogs begin to bark at the frickin' spiral. So again, listen, there's something here. And it's, again, the connection between nature and that force, whatever it is, as embodied, as symbolized by that spiral. I had forgotten to mention that. And it is important just to throw it back.
Yeah.
But to keep our momentum going, like we say, we get those revelations about Liz and her professional life falling apart and everybody hating her now because she's so harsh on everybody. But what I couldn't get over, Dave, and it's just worth probably a pause here, is do you remember her absolute rage at that drunk woman who was drunk driving?
Yes.
I mean, the anger in her was monumental.
Yeah.
She wasn't just pissed off or inconvenienced. She was fucking furious. And then she goes and does the same thing. And I'm just wondering what sort of low level of self-esteem has she gotten to that she would do that same thing that seemed to be. I was wondering, like, are we going to find out there's something about a drunk driver and her son and her ex?
That's where my mind went when we saw that originally.
Yeah, the anger there. Yeah,
exactly. And especially because the drunk driver almost hurt another woman with a child. So that was you know, that was where my mind went. And then to do this, yeah, it's just very, very odd. Like, how low have you gotten here? What's the added underlying thing that's triggered this? Is it the fact that Leah has walked out on you and you now feel like you don't have anything left that's worth sticking around for? You know, it is just a really, it's like, because it was such a visceral reaction to that woman and being that drunk. Yeah, it was quite curious.
Yeah, it's a bit jarring, and there's obviously a reason for it. I will say this: whoever's put the show together does seem to have things set up that we're heading towards explanations. I'm going to keep my faith in the fact that we'll get them. We see Evangeline getting the terrible news that her sister's dead. The Coast Guard calls. She takes it very calmly and tells Peter to go home to his family. And then she goes out to the lighthouse. When she gets there, she's on her way there. She sees that the abusive prick from the original one of the first episode, the guy who'd been physically abusive towards his wife. And he gives her the finger as she's passing on the way to the lighthouse. And as you said, then later on, she tears up the lighthouse. She's got thoroughly disproportionate rage about the lack of care that her sister received. The guy tries to point out, look, it's an open facility. I mean, we don't hold people. We don't monitor people. They're here at their own behest. But the rage in her is huge, and she then sees that guy and she takes it out on him, stops her car, attacks him, and then gets roundly pummeled for her troubles. Just then, we're juxtaposing that with Liz crashing her car into the snow and the one-eyed polar bear coming right up the window and looking in. And then Evangeline goes to see Kavik, and that's her default setting. We see a lot of talk about being alone, and she's very, very much in a low place, and he's trying to reassure her. At one stage, he gets down on his knees. It looks like he's going to propose, and he actually is just doing it to distract her so he can straighten out one of her, dislocated fingers. Mm. And she howls in such pain here, Dave, that I thought, my God, it's really actually interesting, because it's only then when she's in pain that she can be vulnerable to the extent that she can accept his affection.
Yeah.
She's a very troubled soul, is Evangeline.
She is. I thought, like, as well, like, when she was, because she was saying to Kavak, you're alone. Why are you alone? And he says to her, I'm not. And part of why he's not is because he has her. Because I think he sees her as more than just a friend with benefits. Do you know, I think he's got far more affection for her. But obviously she has these walls up that she doesn't want to let him in. And he's very much playing the slow game of, you know, trying to break down those walls and let her know that she has somebody, she's not on her own, that he's willing to look after her. And you see how affectionate he is when he's trying to dab away some of the blood and that. But what I thought was interesting with that was, like, when he, like you said, she gets quite vulnerable and quite relaxed, and then he snaps her fingers back into, or finger back into place, and she howls in pain. But it was almost like she didn't realize how much pain and trauma her body was in until that, because she had maybe been in a disassociative state when the violence, like the violent reaction in the lighthouse. Your man behind the counter was a big lump of a lad. He was terrified of her.
Yeah.
And then the fight, it almost made it seem like that fight was an out-of-body experience for her. And she's clearly, like, she has had lumps kicked out of her, gotten back in her car, driven to Kavik's place, and not really seemed to snap back to reality at any point. From when she finds out about her sister, she gets that phone call, it's almost like she slips consciousness and then doesn't come back until Kavak puts a finger back into place. The other thing, just with the sister, that I thought was really interesting is, clearly when Danvers meets her the first time and she's stripping the clothes off, she's just stripping them off and letting them fall on the ground. The second time she does it, she folds everything really neatly. Everything's left very regimented and proper. And then she makes the walk out.
Like the Salal scientists.
Exactly. And I thought that was really, really interesting.
It is. And the only difference is that there's a calm to her. She knowingly walks to the water. Whereas those guys, when they were doing it, like you pointed out earlier on, there was something that was actually terrifying them. But you wonder, were they on their way and then that terror came? Had they just done a similar thing to Julia? And then the fear descended. It's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. And then we're getting to, I think, which is, this is kind of, I think, the high point. Last episode, the end was really very, very strong. It was actually remarkable with two big set piece scenes. And we have one here. It's not as much stuff happens here, but it's, no, it's, that's not true. Just as much stuff happens here. It's very, very, very affecting, the end of the show. It starts with, we see Liz having a dream. And she's, it's an icy graveyard, which is kind of juxtaposed with her and Holden under a blanket, singing Twist and Shout. And like I said, he's covering his eye. Now, bear in mind, I know this sounds like I'm getting obsessive, but for the next couple of scenes, Evangeline has a really fucked up eye. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. I don't think so. So Navarro gets to Liz's house and wakes her up. She's lost the stone spiral. That will. You remember when you were a kid in Neighbours, and you're watching Neighbours or Home and Away or something, and
She didn't lose it, though.
She didn't lose it, no.
It's a Kvack hat, because Kvack asked her what it was.
That's right, so it's at his gaff.
Yeah, but she's because she's blanked most of, like, she wasn't in her own right state of mind, she doesn't remember that.
Yeah, it's a very
she
good
just
point.
Thinks she lost it probably in the fight somewhere.
But I think it's relevant that she thinks she's lost it. I'll tell you what I was saying there is, like, if you remember, like, watching some crappy sitcom when you were a kid or like a soap, and you'd see the director says, now go in for a close up on those keys, or now go over to Bouncer and make sure you see the Bouncer. The dog looks a bit unhappy. And as everyone watching this says, well, obviously this is going to come back later, right? So I thought that it was a bit of an obvious question. I would imagine it's going to have some relevance. Maybe we're going to see Kavik, like you say, in some way being affected by that thing. Let's see how that works. But there's an interaction between the two of them, and we see Danvers at our most sort of rejecting any concept of the supernatural. She goes in several rants. She says dead people are dead. There's no heaven. There's no hell. There's no ghosts. There's nobody out there watching us. And, you know, I think Evangeline says, well, why do you keep that toy around? Because at one stage she says, was that his? And Liz, because remember Evangeline had a dream where she saw Holden's arm and she saw the toy. And she says, was that his? And Liz ignores it. And she says, well, why do you keep that thing around? And she goes and throws it out in the snow. And she comes back in, continuing her rant. There's nothing, she says, except us. We're here all alone. The dead are gone. They're fucking gone, she says. And at that point, Evangeline decides it'd be a good idea to tell her about her sister being dead. And of course, Danvers feels shitty about it. It calms down a bit, and we find out that the sister had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, with bipolar, with borderline personality disorder. But Evangeline doesn't think it's any of those things. Evangeline is now firmly convinced that it, like you referred to earlier on, takes us one by one. And she says, you know who's next. Now, Liz can't handle this. Liz says, listen, you're an intelligent woman. That was really pointed comment, because that's Liz saying, no, let's ask the right questions. Let's get back to the science here. Let's, let's put our faith in rationality. But Evangeline is not for turning. She says, I failed her. She says, it's a curse. Something calls us and we follow it. It comes for us, she says. And at this point, then we get this second flashback to the Wheeler thing. Because Liz says, you're doing the thing you did with Wheeler. You saw something, it was a ghost or a spirit, And then we see that freaky flashback where Evangeline is staring. Liz can't see what she sees. It's like the scene in Macbeth with Banquo's ghost. But it's a screaming, screeching, horrifying version of the lady who's been killed. And Evangeline says that she didn't see anything. Liz calls her a liar and Evangeline storms out. It's a powerful set piece, that, Dave.
It's a really good scene. It's a really good scene. And it's again, it's an insight into Danvers and the pain that she carries with her. The dead are gone. They're just gone. Obviously, a reference to her son, her ex. We've obviously, you know, the other couple of breadcrumbs that we mentioned earlier, maybe potentially killed by a drunk driver, something, or maybe the husband was drunk when he drove, something like that. We've heard from Christopher Eccleston's character that, you know, she was bad before. She was always a bit of an arsehole. Then she became a full-blown arsehole after that. So, again, that points to where most of her damage comes from. We've heard her say there is no God. It's a commonly held view that if there is a God, why does a God let children die? You know, so maybe at one point Danvers was a bit more open-minded, a bit more religious, a bit more spiritual, and has been hardened against any of that because of what happened. But then when Navarro mentions her sister dying, she does immediately soften. And like you said, you can tell she feels terrible for what she said, because she understands that both, you know, Navarro's lost her sister and Navarro does believe in that type of stuff. So now you're basically, you know, her sister's dead and now you're saying that she's gone forever. You know, she's not going to have that spiritual link that the native folk would have, you know, rely on when somebody passes away. It's a really powerful scene. And just that, the scene of her, you know, throwing the toy out, almost as if, because it's in an evidence box, remember? Like, it's when she lifts the evidence box and the arse falls out of it, the toy falls out of the box.
Yeah.
So why is it in an evidence box?
Yeah, that's a good
clearly
point,
clearly an unsolved crime.
Brilliant. I hadn't thought about that.
Do you know? So, maybe it's just that that's how she keeps things in her own house, because she can't separate work from home life anymore. Maybe she's so wrapped up in her work that everything gets put into evidence boxes. You know, there could be that side of it as well. But it is a really powerful scene. And again, it shows that there's obviously this division between them, but there is more than just this sort of, you know, fondness. There's a real connection between the two. You can tell that they at one point were much more than just partners on the job. They were very, very close at one point, and there is a lot of care. And Danvers, being that bit older, does sort of look out for Navarro a little bit, maybe kind of feels like an older sister towards her or whatever. So it's a really, really good scene. It's really well paced as well. Like, they don't try and rush into anything. Just when Navarro comes in, there's no blurting out of "my sister's just died" or anything. They wait and they wait and they wait, and then they drop that line at the key point.
Absolutely. And I'm reminded, I thought you mentioned the word sister, that I forgot earlier on a little important detail that people will be screaming at their various devices that we should mention here as well, because the orange returned earlier on, because we see the lead up to what happens to Evangeline's sister, and she's sitting there in the lighthouse and an orange rolls out from under the bed in the same way as it happened to Evangeline out in the ice. And for the first time of about three times, there's a horrible screeching presence somewhere in this episode. And when she looks under the bed, which I would imagine has literally ruined the childhood of several people who are watching this at an age way too young to be watching it, under the bed, it seems to be her mother. She's got that crucifix anyway. And we see a hand move, we see the eye open, and we hear that screeching sound. And that's the final straw for Julie, who at that point. The next time we see her, she's walking naked towards the water. And we're now getting to the final kind of scene of this particular episode. And we were brought there by the fact that just as Navarro is taken off in her truck after falling out with Liz again, the Liz arrives with a picture on her phone of Clark. And Clark is wearing the pink parka and he's out at the dredges. And there's a whole new thing for us. This, you know, the idea of this old technology that used to be very much part of their lives when they were young. Evangeline says she remembers it being very much part of their lives. It was a very impressive thing. And now it's apparently out there rotting and falling apart and, you know, forgotten. And Liz actually with a very revealing line says, yeah, well, aren't we all? And when we get there to the dredges, the first thing we see is a sign that says keep off the grass, which is mad, right? It's spray painted onto some metallic thing inside a whole big metallic shell in a big metallic structure. Weird. Then we see the spiral on the wall. And by the way, the keep off the grass thing could at a stretch be a season one reference. It could be, because when we see the big bad from season one for the first time, he's on a little ride on lawnmower and that one of those scenes are in the background. As they're making their way around trying to explore this place, the dredges, and it's all, like you say, gantries and ladders and metal platforms. We hear a voice as Liz has just moved on. And it calls out to Evangeline and she stops and Liz goes on and Evangeline pauses and sees her sister below floating by in a sort of a canal underneath. We hear distorted music. Oh, sorry. As she goes down to investigate, we can see wet footprints coming out from that, whatever that sort of artificial channel is that the water was in. And we see wet footprints, bare feet coming out of it. And in the background, then we see a Christmas tree all lit up. There's some distorted music that comes on. And of course, you get your fantastic jump scare when Evangeline turns around and there's a freaky screaming version of what looks like her sister right in her face, which is it's shocking, it's properly scary, it really works, it got me. I was you're expecting it, you know something's coming, but it really, fair play, they did. There's something about that open mouth thing and the high pitch, that whatever pitch they've got that scream at is, yeah, genuinely unnerving. And by the time Danvers gets there, Evangeline is bleeding from the ear, she's in some sort of catatonic state, and it's bad. That's how the episode ends. But there's also this parallel thing happening, Dave, where Liz is off on her own chase. She's chasing the original sound that they heard. Turns out it's Otis. When she gets there, he is in a pink parka. He's standing in a really weird way with his head down and the hood down, pulled down over his face. The jacket, the parka, has one of those yellow smiley faces on it, which could be a throwaway reference to Smiley Face Killer and all those kind of things that seem to have that one particular symbol in common. But Otis comes out with a few great lines. Where's Clark? He's asked. He's gone, he says. He went back down to hide. Fantastic. Where's he gone down to? What's he hiding from? And he continues, he's hiding in the night country. And then we're all in the night country now. I have to say, as endings go, again nailed, because it was just that two-parter thing going on at the same time. They're both having their revelations. Obviously Evangeline's is a bit more horrific. It seems to have had this impact on her. Like I said, when Liz finds her, she's bleeding from her ear. Yeah. And she looks borderline catatonic. But the oldest thing is really interesting as well. What sort of creature is he? What does he mean by Clark's gone down to hide? What does he mean by we're all in the night country? And three cheers for the fact that we finally got around to hearing the night country, which is, of course, what the whole season is called. It's a strong ending, Dave. I really liked it.
Yeah, it's a brilliant ending. It's a genuinely brilliant ending. And it does sort of... The Otis scene, obviously, there's, like you said, there's those two things happening at one place where Danvers has pursued Otis and kind of cornered him, and Navarro has had a vision and gone off. And again, like we said earlier, almost she seems to be having some sort of out-of-body experience. And when Danvers pushes her hair back and you see her bleeding from the ear, and you're kind of wondering, is that something that's just happened now? Is that from the fight? Because it's not that long since the fight.
It's not, but wasn't burst eardrums and burnt corneas the two things. All the Salal people had in common?
That's very true. That's very, very true. It's a really good ending to an episode. Like, it's a really good ending because it just raises more questions. Like, yeah. It's brilliant. It gives us some answers and then raises 20 more questions. And the oldest thing is really good, like, because he's clearly been through some stuff. He's seen some bits and he's got the burst cornea. He's clearly terrified out of his mind with fear, panicked, doesn't really seem to know where he is. Like you said, the way he answers the questions about Clark, the line, we're all in the night country. Like, it's really, really good. It's really, really good. And it sets up the last two episodes to be potentially massive.
I won't lie to you, because I've got such high expectations for this, because because we've committed to this show and I want it to be good because of this show as much as anything else, to be perfectly honest. There were times during this episode where I was going, you know, I was getting a little bit nervous about the fact that it was just playing out like almost in places. You had the comedic bits, you had the character building and all that kind of thing, but they're just like I alluded to earlier on, vaguely pedestrian aspect of just you drip fed little bits to help develop the various characters, but yet again stuck the ending like a boss here, because like you say, we're left with more questions than answers. And like I started off the show, I've all those questions, like, why is Liz not rattled by the bear thing? Why do all of these things, when they appear, seem to be pointing? And what's the screeching noises about? And why do people see things in Ennis? And what are all the eye things about, the constant eye symbolism? You know, is there a cult here? What's the swirl, the whole thing around this world? Is there going to be some sort of cult at the back of it? And again, even just simple things like, what's the lighthouse and the idea of light and dark in this? Is it being used in a really obvious way or in a way that's a little bit different? I absolutely delighted with the fact that I'm left with all these questions as we go into the last two episodes. And if people are interested in enjoying it, like Dave says, we have two left as episode 5 and 6 will play out. And then we will do at least one kind of recap. And depending on your responses at that point, we might do another kind of answering questions one or something like that, just to round out the whole thing in a kind of 8-episode bundle. Little bit of inside baseball. Want to just say we are genuinely both enjoying the hell out of this. It's a new departure for us, but not exactly a new departure for us in terms of interest. New departure for us in terms of being able to do on a regular basis something that we kind of do have an interest in, that we're not just these one-trick football ponies. So we do appreciate your support. We do appreciate the kind comments. We do appreciate anything you have by way of setting your ears towards this. It is an important thing, I think it's safe to say, to both of us. I don't think I'm talking outside of school there, Dave, to say that. We do really want to build this show. So if you're liking it, you know that this isn't like the Liverpool shows. This is something that you can tell anyone about, and they don't have to be a football fan. So please do that. I think that's a fair thing to say, Dave. If we could get anything from folks at all, it would be just really, really, really appreciated if they'd spread the word.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As I've said this a few times, it's the most enjoyable thing that I'm doing right now, podcast wise. And it's something that's important to both of us, that we do really want to make it, you know, a good swing at, like. And the more ears that this falls on, the better. And we would be greatly appreciative of any help in growing this new little adventure for the two of us.
For sure. And we will be back with episode 5 next week. And we will be back with our second one of the week very soon as well. I think we can reveal that it's going to be a sci-fi classic, Predator. I did, by the way, and there's a chap who's going to be listening this evening, and I want to just say, I'm not ignoring your advice. I did get a DM, Dave. Someone said, you know, maybe don't do these big popular movies. Maybe do something that's slightly, you know, less well known. And I think we can reassure people that if this show takes hold, we'll absolutely go down those routes.
Oh, yeah.
But for now, you'll have to forgive us. We're trying to be a little bit populist. That's the whole idea. We want to make this show, you know, interesting to as many people as possible, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I'm like... So, Predator is one of the quintessential 80s movies. And we did The Rock, which was a quintessential 90s movie. But the other factor as well is that Carl Weathers passed away. And we wanted to do something that was, you know, yeah, a little bit of a tribute to him. And Rocky was just far too obvious, you know. So Predator just seemed like the right way. And I have to say, I've seen it a bunch of times. I rarely enjoyed rewatching something as much as I did watching Predator. I watched it last night and absolutely loved it.
Oh, same as that, man. I wasn't expecting to. Like, I had these cliched ideas because I honestly hadn't seen it in probably a couple of decades. And really looking forward to the chat on that one. So that will be our second one of the week. We will be back with episode 5 and another film for you in the week to come and all the succeeding weeks to come, assuming neither of us dies of consumptive fits in the meantime. But I think we're going to be on the mend at that stage. So thanks for your ears, thanks for your attention. I've been Trev Denny, that's Dave Hendrick, this is Buzz, and we'll be back with you very soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.